A legal challenge to Miami-Dade County's immigration detention policy, the trauma of separating children from their parents, and a tool to fight back against sexual assault in hotels. Welcome to the Florida Roundup. I'm Nadege Green. Tom Hudson is out this week. Two undocumented immigrants are suing Miami-Dade County over its immigration detention policy. The lawsuit was filed in federal court this week and claims the county's policy is unconstitutional. Also, children were being separated from their parents at U.S. border crossings. And now the children of TPS holders face being separated when that policy ends for Haitians and others. We look at new research on how family separation affects children's health. And Miami Beach introduces panic buttons to help protect hotel housekeepers from sexual harassment and assault. All that and your phone calls coming up on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Joining us in studio today to talk about the county's policy and the lawsuit is Miami-Dade County Mayor Carlos Jimenez. Thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
And Danny Rivero, WLRN reporter, who has been covering this issue.
Thanks for having me.
First, let's start with the lawsuit. Danny, you were at the press conference this week with immigration groups who were part of the suit. What did they say about why they're suing?
The underlying reasoning behind this lawsuit is that they're alleging that this policy itself, that the detainers themselves and honoring those detainers is unconstitutional because they say that it causes someone to be held in custody after they're otherwise able to go free once they've posted bond. But instead of being able to go free, they're then held in the county facility until federal officers are able to actually take them into custody and then start with the deportation proceedings.
Mayor Jimenez, how do you respond to those concerns that the county's policy to hold people for immigration authorities is unconstitutional?
Obviously, we believe it is constitutional, and I guess the courts will decide whether it is or not.
And I imagine that's where the county stands on the lawsuit right now.
Yes.
President Trump had commended you for leading the way in reversing this policy. Mm-hmm. Which before last year was not to honor these type of detention requests. Just walk us through why you decided to honor them.
Well, this all actually started under the Obama administration. The Obama administration, when we changed the policy back, I believe, in 13 for a couple of years, it was because we were not getting reimbursed for the time that these detainer requests were costing Miami-Dade County. And so the policy was reversed at the time when we would not honor unless we were actually given the funds by the federal government. In retrospect, it was probably a bad decision to reverse course. Not now. It was actually a bad decision back in 2013. We probably should have just maintained our posture of honoring the requests. And then what is this? What is really this is all about? Some people think that somehow Miami-Dade County is involved in immigration enforcement, and we're not. We simply, anybody and everybody who's arrested in Miami-Dade County, their records, their fingerprints, their mugshots, et cetera, go out to a number of other agencies around the United States, one of them being immigration, for obvious reasons. If somebody's wanted, say, for murder or something, or in another state, or by the federal government for some other offense, then they would be aware that we have that individual in our custody. We don't identify anybody as being undocumented. So anybody who ICE then says, hey, we are interested in that person, means that ICE already has that person on their radar.
Right. This is ICE knows that this person, that they were already looking for this person, that they already had a deportation hearing.
That's correct.
But just to step back, this did start under the Obama administration where the county was actually honoring the detainer request, but in 2013 stopped, mm-hmm. saying that the county wanted to be reimbursed from the federal government.
Right.
And now we're back here. Is the county being reimbursed from the federal government?
We're working with that. But again, the administration actually said that we were a sanctuary city and that our funds were in jeopardy. It started with the Obama administration back in May of 2016. And myself and certain commissioners were working with Washington to reverse that. And we were not successful in getting the sanctuary city labeled reversed under the Obama administration, obviously not under the Trump administration. In retrospect, though, when I say that it was not a good idea to do what we did back in 2013, is that when you actually start looking at, you know, who are these folks that ICE is interested in, 65% are felons, over 65% also are repeat offenders. And a lot of these folks have pretty serious charges against them. The other fact is this: we have basically about 1,000 detainer requests from ICE since this program started, and there are over 150,000 what we believe undocumented immigrants here in Miami-Dade County. So, which this is really far less than 1% of the total undocumented immigrants here in Miami-Dade County.
Danny, I would love for you to weigh in on that, because that has been a point of contention within the community, is the why people are being picked up, why people are being arrested. What are you hearing from some of the folks in the community who have been detained, or some of the organizations that are working with them?
The organizations that have been working with them, and the plaintiffs particularly in this lawsuit, are not necessarily named, so we haven't been able to speak to them individually. But we hear that there's two things, because the federal government is the one that enforces immigration policy. And when someone enters into the local criminal justice system, they're held on local charges. And then what's happening here is it's almost a compounding effect, because the people who are held in local jails, they're not posting bond, because they know as soon as they post bond, if they have a detainer, they're going to be then transferred over to the federal authorities, and then deportation proceedings will start. So there's been reports that have come out have found that because people are not posting bond, they're actually spending much more time in these county facilities and actually costing taxpayers more dollars, because people are spending more time in the jails. And the other part of this is that there's a period of time, this 48 hours, that people are held not necessarily on a local charge. They should, according to local laws, be released, but they're being held temporarily in order to be turned over to the federal government. And that is that's a major point of contention, that there is this period where there seems to be no legal justification for holding these people, according to these lawsuits.
We're talking about Miami-Dade County's immigration detention policy. We would love to hear from you. Call us at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. You can also tweet us at WLRN. Mayor Jimenez, there's been a lot of backlash from this. You've seen the protests outside of your offices within the county about this change. Is there something about it that you feel that is being misunderstood?
Yeah, I think that a lot of people feel that somehow Miami-Dade County is actively enforcing immigration status, and we don't. So our police officers are only enforcing the laws that they normally enforce. We're not an immigration police agency. We don't go into anybody's home and find out what your immigration status is. When you're arrested, we don't ask you what your immigration status is. When you're arrested because we think that you did something that violated a law of Miami-Dade County, either a federal, state, or local law, and you're processed like everybody else. It's only after, when we send out the information to everybody, that we find out that ICE has a particular interest in an individual. We don't flag that individual as being undocumented. I think a lot of people think that when the change of policy, that somehow Miami-Dade County became involved in enforcing immigration law, and we don't. What we do is, when a federal agency such as ICE asks us to detain the individual, and they have there's paperwork that they have to file with us in order for us to do that, when they do that, then we will honor that request for up to 48 hours, which we believe is legal, and that's I guess is the point of contention of the lawsuit.
Yeah. So I just wanted to bring back a lot of the kind of backlash from the advocacy groups here is that the stated justification for the change of policy was that the federal government was kind of holding federal funds in question. An executive order issued by President Donald Trump said that for sanctuary cities that that it's the federal government cannot hold those funds. So, and in addition to that, we know that people are staying in local jails for longer because they're not posting bond. And the mayor just told us that they're still working on the reimbursement issue. So I think a big question for the local advocacy groups is, what is the county actually getting out of this? What is the justification for doing this if all these things that were at play don't necessarily seem to be in effect right now?
Well, because there are, as I showed you with the statistics, and I showed them with statistics, I mean, everybody wants to paint people in the same brush. Everybody's the same. Immigrants are great. Immigrants are not great. Well, most immigrants are great, but there are some that are not. And the stats that we have that some of the people that we picked up are actually, like I said, they're felons. Some have had some pretty significant charges like murder, rape, armed assault, drugs. A lot of them were repeat offenders. And so it's also a question of public safety, but not to the point where they say, you know, that everybody wants to make that, hey, you know, you have an undocumented immigrant that murdered somebody, okay, and that, you know, that's representative of the immigration or the undocumented immigrants. It's not. Like I said, we have over 150,000 undocumented immigrants that we believe here in this county. We're talking about 1,000. This is far less than 1%.
And also included in the people who get picked up, though, are not just violent offenders. There are also people who get picked up for suspended licenses, for example. You also have folks who are repeated offenders in driving without a suspended license
I said 65%.
No, I was just mentioning.
I got it. And so, but again, see, everybody wants to paint everybody with the same broad stroke. We're not painting everybody with the same broad stroke. What we are doing, though, is we're treating everybody the same. And so when you get arrested, anybody else gets arrested in Miami-Dade County, they go through exactly the same procedure. That information is given out. Now, the only thing that may be different is maybe you don't have a warrant from a federal government that says we'd like that individual held for us so that we can then pick them up. But if you have a warrant from the federal government for some other offense, yeah, we'll hold you, okay, until the federal government can come and pick you up if they have an arrest warrant. In this case, this is a form that they filed that said we are interested in that individual. The fact that they're interested in that individual says that they've already had contact with ICE.
Absolutely.
Before.
That is what an immigration detainer is.
Right.
ICE knows who they are.
Exactly.
We're going to go to the phones. We have Renata from Margate. Renata, thank you for joining us. Renata, are you on the line?
Yes. I am an immigration attorney, and although I am not in agreement with certain percentages of I haven't come into contact with the data that the mayor is sharing, but I would like to say that individuals who are detained for driving without a license are frequently just being used in this immigration dispute. More often than not, they do not have any criminal history. More often than not, they're caught going or coming from work. And unfortunately, cities like Miami have been caught in the middle of this desperate need to detain immigrants. The Broward Transitional Center, which is where most individuals without a criminal record who are stopped and detained for driving without a license are detained, has an incredibly high deportation rate. Certain judges in that detention center deport about 98% of the individuals who are detained there. And most often than not, they came into custody for driving without a license. Unfortunately, for the longest time, immigrant advocates have been advocating for a license for undocumented individuals in Florida, but we were unable to reach that benefit, and here we are discussing this mass amount of individuals being deported for driving without a license.
We also have Jason from
Can I say something? I mean,
sure. Before we go to Jason, can respond to that.
We have 1,000 total people here in Miami-Dade County that were picked up by ICE, I guess, since the program started. 65% of them are actually felons, so that's not driving without a license. That means 35%, maybe 350 were not felonies. There were some kind of misdemeanors. So when you say massive, I mean, what is massive, I guess, for 350 people out of 150,000. Again, most of the undocumented here in Miami-Dade County, they live their life.
Mayor Jimenez, the data that you are citing, this is the county data from...
Absolutely. It's from our corrections department.
And we're going to go to Jason. Jason, from Miami, thank you for joining us.
I just want to say, I feel very, very bad and empathetic for these people that are being detained on something that's not necessarily a felony. But my concern, where I have to agree with the mayor, is that we're all expected to be signers of a social contract, where we don't actually sign it, but we have certain expectations where we live in society, and we expect that society to protect us and be good to us if we cooperate, even though we don't necessarily sign something. So just even if it's not a felony, you should be expected to follow the rules of the land that you're living in and cooperate with that society to the best of your ability until you can be a full member.
Thank you, Jason. So follow the laws and don't get picked up, don't get arrested. Danny, do you have a response on that? Thank you, Jason.
Yes, I think, obviously that is in Miami-Dade County as well as in all parts of the country, that is a train of thought. And there's a lot of support for that. I think for this particular issue, one thing that we should focus on is the county's stated justification for implementing this policy, and that was the loss of potential federal dollars. So, I was looking at the minutes of that particular meeting, and Mayor Jimenez, you said, and I'm quoting the minutes from that, said that noncompliance could potentially result in the loss of approximately $355 million of federal funding that the county received for critical programs. It seems that that's not any longer the case because the several courts have found that the federal government can't hold those dollars kind of hostage.
And when you say several courts, you're talking about cases in California.
Yeah, they're not here, but the ducks seem to be lining up.
By the
way,
the federal courts in California, the Ninth District, is probably overturned 85% of the time.
Correct.
Right? Is that correct?
I don't know the particular.
No, I do. It's about 85% of the time. When it gets through, their cases get to the Supreme Court, they're overturned about 85% of the time.
But to continue the what I was stating is that the federal dollars don't seem, because Chicago has actually taken this to court, and they've that's ongoing because the federal government was trying to withhold funds, and we know that is costing the local corrections department a little bit more money. So the question
that federal dollars are at risk for Miami-Dade County?
Oh, I believe that the federal dollars are at risk, but the caveat that I said is that in retrospect, really after looking at this data, it's more than just the federal dollars. It is, when we did this, I was unaware of who these folks were and what they were being picked up for. And so in that case, I think that this policy is the right policy. The vast majority of jurisdictions in the United States follow this policy. And so for me, it's also a case of public safety. Again, not to say that, and believe me, because I'm actually an advocate of comprehensive immigration reform. My office gave $25,000 this year to Impact Immigration Partnership and Coalition Fund in order to help with the defense of undocumented immigrants here in Miami-Dade County to defend them. We will give another $25,000 next year and continue to do that. We've also put $100,000 into the Office of New Americans as actually part of my office. So, this is a small sliver of the undocumented immigrants in Miami-Dade County. A small sliver.
And though it is a small sliver, one of the major impacts of this has been fear that this could cause eroding trust in police department and law enforcement agencies. And we have heard from social service agencies who say there are people who are impacted by crime who are afraid to call the police now. They may be victimized by crime, but feel that if the police show up, that this could potentially harm them and their families. You know, you have the case of one of the plaintiffs in this lawsuit who has 8 children and a business who faces now deportation. And so that is a very real fear within the community. Do you think those fears are valid?
Well, the fears are exacerbated by the people that claim that they don't want the fears, because we've been very clear. Our police officers are not immigration officers. Our police officers don't ask you about immigration status. If you are the victim of a crime, please let us know, because nobody's going to ask you about your immigration status. You're the victim. Nobody's going to arrest you. If you are a criminal here in Miami-Dade County and you're undocumented, you need to fear us. If you're a criminal and you are a citizen of Miami-Dade County, you need to fear the Miami-Dade Police Department, because we treat them the same. And so what is happening is, because of this, people that are in the advocacy group, all right, say, oh, these are the things that are going to happen. Be careful to the Miami-Dade Police Department, because is going to happen. I really need to explain our position. There is absolutely nothing to fear from the Miami-Dade Police Department. They are not and will never be immigration officers.
Thank you. Miami-Dade Mayor Carlos Jimenez talking about the county's immigration detention policy with us. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And WLRN reporter Danny Rivero, who's been following this issue. Thank you, Danny.
Thank you.
Up next, the long-term health effects of separating children from their undocumented immigrant parents. Call us at 800-743-WLRN. I'm Nadege Green. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Hundreds of children have been separated from their parents at the U.S. border. Some are being held here in South Florida. The U.S. government has said it will no longer separate children from their parents. But experts say for many of the children who were separated, the damage is already done. Amanda Escalante is a coordinator at the Guatemalan Maya Center in Lake Worth. She shared her observations after meeting with some of the separated children.
The toxic stress is affecting developmental delays, specifically affecting the language area of their brain. The kids are having bad dreams, and this affects the health of the child.
And that trauma can make children physically ill. Ashley Marchante Hoffman just received her PhD in psychology at the University of Miami, and her dissertation looked at the impact of psychological trauma in Latino youth who experience violence and separation from their families.
Then what I found was that they were experiencing headaches, stomach aches, sleep problems. It can even result in more long-term physical complications like obesity and heart disease.
The topic of separating children from their parents isn't just a concern at the border. As temporary protected status ends for Haitians and other groups, local social service agencies have also raised concerns about what will happen to the children of TPS holders. La Grande Jeanne is 7 years old. She was born in the U.S., but her mom was born in Haiti, and she has TPS, temporary protected status.
I feel confused.
If you had a mother and just a daughter, and the mother got deported from the child, what would happen to the child?
Immigration, trauma, and health outcomes for children. Call us at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. You can also tweet us at WLRN. We're joined by Tim Padgett, WLRN's America's correspondent in studio. Thank you for being here, Tim.
Thank you, Nadege.
And we're joined by Jacqueline Charles, reporter at the Miami Herald from Doral.
Thank you for having me.
Tim, can you give us some examples on how the kids who have been separated from the parents are doing from the recent report that you reported?
Well, the research that you cited by Ashley Marchant-Hoffman at the University of Miami, this was done over 2 years before this family separation policy of the Trump administration came into effect. But it greatly informs what we could be seeing as the result of these separations of parents and children as a result of the Trump policy today. What she found was, after observing more than 150 children, immigrant children from Central and South America and Mexico, who were using this mobile pediatric clinic at the University of Miami, what she found was that overwhelmingly, I think more than two-thirds of them had experienced some sort of immigration-related trauma, whether it was the violence back home that prodded the family to immigrate in the first place, or whether it was separation from a parent or a caregiver during that immigration process. And what she found was that all of those kids who had experienced things like that ended up not just having psychological trauma, but physical conditions, such as she pointed out, you know, loss of sleep, headaches, and especially stomach aches, you know, so ulcerous conditions. And what she found was that these can often also then result in more long-term conditions like, as she pointed out, heart disease, obesity, a lot of things that then start manifesting themselves in adulthood. And this is something that's got to be a real concern for not just immigrants, but for the Latino community as a whole in this country, because the Latino community, in large part, is immigrants.
And we've been paying a lot of attention to family separations at the U.S. border, but in immigrant communities, some version of family separation has always been happening.
Sure.
As you note, this is a study based off of separation before what we're seeing.
Mm-hmm.
Jackie, what does mental health support look like in something like the Haitian community, for example?
Well, you know, I've had conversations with several religious leaders in the last couple of weeks about this issue, and they admit to me that they themselves are struggling in terms of how do you counsel families, TPS holders, with this issue. I mean, today we are a year away from TPS ending, and families are going to have to start to make those decisions. Do you leave with your child, or do you leave your child here? And unfortunately, in the Haitian community, this is not a new issue for them. They've been through this before, either because they themselves left Haiti and came to the U.S. and then eventually sent for their children, you know, or this is their, you know, upbringing, that they have this history. So, again, you know, what the social service agencies are saying is that our doors are open. We're here to listen to you. But in the end, they really cannot tell a family what to do. It ultimately has to be decided by that family, the best choice, the best decision for them.
And TPS ends for thousands of Haitians in July of 2019. What are you hearing so far? How are families starting to prepare for these separations?
I don't think families are preparing. I think that, you know, in the Haitian community, people are still holding on to some hope that, you know, they're going to get a reprieve from TPS. You know, this idea of packing up, you know, for some 30 years of their life and then moving back to Haiti is just unimaginable for them. And when you think about, in terms of just the education, if you think about a child who is around middle school age, and if you want to go to Haiti with that child who's been educated in an English system, for you to afford to send that child to an English system school in Haiti, we're talking about tens of thousands of dollars. So people are not there yet. I think that as the months go on, that is when the reality is really going to hit them. And I don't even know then if it's going to hit them. But it is a major issue. I mean, and that's what lawyers are saying to people. Listen, you need to start to put together some sort of a power of attorney. Who will have the decision-making authority when it comes to your child should you be picked up after TPS ends and you have no documentation? If you choose to go back to Haiti and leave this child, you need to make sure that you leave some sort of a legal framework. So the advice to the Haitian community, as well as the Honduran communities and the Nicaraguan community, is listen, do not delay. Start to make some arrangements, even if you have not decided that you're going to return. Make sure legally your child is protected should something happen to you.
And these are arrangements that, at least in the Latino immigrant communities I know, have really been underway for a while. You go to Homestead, you go to places like Lake Worth that have, you know, very high concentrations of Latino immigrants. They have been conducting legal seminars, for example, for families to show them how to put together affidavits that instruct caregivers, you know, on what's going to happen with my, say, U.S.-born child, who's going to be the who's going to adopt this child, or who's going to be the caregiver for this child. So we are seeing a lot of legal work going on in these communities to help these families, you know, figure out what's going to happen.
You're listening to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Nadege Green. We're talking about how separating children from their undocumented immigrant parents can have long-term negative health effects. Call us at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. You can also tweet us at WLRN. You know, Jackie, we talk about how lawyers are very much a central part of this conversation, but should healthcare providers be folded into what is happening within the community to respond accordingly, as we saw from the mobile clinic that Tim was able to report on?
I do believe so, because, you know, we have, you know, this issue, and it's a psychological impact. I mean, I've seen it in my own family. I've seen it in other families where you have a family that is now reunited, but there's still issues, underlying issues of abandonment, of separation. And that seems to be the history in this community. And now here we are going into a new chapter of this, and people are having to face this. You know, oftentimes the Haitian parents are going to say, I'm making this decision, it's best for you, but what about that child? Often we don't give voice to the child. So I think that we really do need to have some mental health provisions and providers that work with this community, as well as attorneys, real attorneys, that can really help and guide them, and so that they can really start to get their house in order, so to speak.
Yeah, and one of the things that researchers like Marchante Hoffman have found is that immigrant communities, particularly Latino immigrant communities in this country, they really tend not to avail themselves as much as they should of pediatric mental health services. They do. They will take, you know, their children to pediatric medical services. So what researchers like her are advocating now is that we get more psychologists, more of that kind of personnel into the medical clinics, so that they can start responding to these issues as well.
And Tim, did the findings of this research also look at in providing care for young people who are impacted by immigration trauma to also have culturally competent care providers, people who speak the language, people who understand the culture that they're going into?
Definitely. I mean, Ashley Marchante Hoffman that I was just talking about, I think one of the things that really struck her was, you know, her parents immigrated here from Cuba when they were kids, and she saw just how important it is to have professionals like herself who are bilingual, you know, taking care of these kinds of services. You know, that's definitely a factor.
And stigma, I imagine, is a part of this with accessing mental health services in any community, but particularly in Caribbean and Latin American communities. How do you start to overcome that stigma and something so personal like what is happening within the immigration community?
Sure. I mean, you Central America, South America, Mexico, there's not as, I guess, as elevated a culture of pediatric mental health care there as we have here in the United States. We tend to take it for granted in the 21st century. That's still not the case in Central and South America and Mexico. And so, yes, we really do need to be, making it known more to immigrant communities here that they can avail themselves of that kind of service.
And let me say, the school system, though, also is a key component.
Right.
And I remember last year talking to the superintendent and he addressing this fact that they have counselors that are working with students whose parents are TPS holders. And so that is a real important component here. So I think that even for young children, that they should avail themselves of their school counselors and be willing to open up and to talk about what they are going through.
And Jackie, can you speak to having those conversations with the adults to be able to have children open up, particularly in the Haitian community where often the kids don't talk like that to their parents?
It's a very difficult challenge, you know, in terms of mental health. I mean, in the Haitian community, this is not something that we readily embrace, you know, ourselves. And we don't usually think of children as being independent and having an independent voice. So I think that this is where the community leaders need to step up. This is where the pastors and the priests and also other people that have taken the leadership on this issue to really talk to TPS holders, you know, not just about what you're going to do or getting your legal paperwork ready, but how to avail yourself and to give your children the access to talk to somebody and respect the fact that they have an opinion and that they are going to, they're feeling a lot about what is going to happen.
Well, no, I would agree completely because as one of the people that we quoted there at the beginning of this segment pointed out is that one of the areas of the brain, for example, that gets very adversely affected by things like parent-child separation in cases like this is the language area of the brain. Kids sort of withdraw into themselves and their expression, their linguistic expression becomes corroded, as it were. And so if we're not letting these kids talk now about this, we're looking at people who, as they become adults, coming out of the immigration community, are going to be very withdrawn, not going to be very verbally expressive as they should be.
And Tim, in your reporting, were there any outreach? Like, how do you get this beyond this circle, this bubble, to get the healthcare providers, to get schools, for example, and other providers within the community talking about not just the legal implications of immigration, but also the mental health impact that this is having?
Well, again, it's getting the psychologist into, for example, you know, when you have newly arrived immigrant families here, whether it's from Nicaragua or from Haiti or wherever, often, you know, you're going to find these children in pediatric medical settings. settings. Now, they'll be looking at their physical health. But one of the things that we have to do, according to these research, is we've got to start getting the psychological, mental health pediatric services people into those settings so that when a kid is complaining of, an immigrant child is complaining of bad stomach aches, inability to sleep, things of that nature, the psychologist can then start showing that, look, this is not just because of solely because of physical reasons. This has psychological roots as well.
And Jackie, you were at a press conference not too long ago at the Little Haiti Cultural Center where children of TPS holders spoke about how they were feeling. What did they say?
Well, I mean, they have anxiety. You know, they themselves are trying to understand exactly what does this mean. I remember, you know, talking to a father a couple of months ago, and, you know, his two children, you know, they are very much ingrained. They have after-school activities. One is, you know, into basketball. And I talked to him about the possibility of moving back to Haiti and integrating these kids. And this is a father who doesn't want to leave his children in the U.S. He doesn't want to just leave them to anybody to raise them. But at the same time, financially, he can't afford to integrate these kids, you know, in Haiti. And I said, do you talk to your kids? Do they understand what's coming? And you can see that they hear the words, but they don't fully comprehend. And, you know, the advocates here in the community, I mean, they have been fighting the legal battle, and a lot of them are doing it on shoestring budgets. But I think that now is the time for them, some of them, to at least switch gears and to really think about the mental health. Because going forward, we're talking about the future of these children in terms of, as adults, their ability to relate to people, abandonment issues, you know, their ability to be productive members of society, whether it's here or whether it's in Haiti or Honduras or Nicaragua. And I think that that is really what needs to happen now in the next couple of months, because it's not just Haiti, but it's a number of countries that are going to start to lose TPS if nothing else changes.
That's Jackie Charles with the Miami Herald. Thank you so much for joining us, Jackie. And Tim Padgett, WLRN's America's correspondent.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, housekeepers on Miami Beach are getting safety buttons to help fight sexual harassment and assault. Call us at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Nadege Green. The city of Miami Beach voted unanimously to arm hotel workers with something they're calling safety buttons. The devices, called panic buttons in other cities that have used them, can be pressed to summon hotel security if a hotel worker feels like they're in danger. It's meant to curb sexual harassment and sexual assault, something that hotel workers nationally say is far too common. Joining us from the Miami Herald in Doral is Chibeli Herrera, reporter with the Miami Herald. Thank you so much for being here, Chibeli.
Thanks, Nadege.
When will Miami Beach hotel workers start carrying these panic buttons, and how did this idea come up in the first place?
Yeah, so we're going to see this implemented next year in August. They wanted to give a year for the hotels to start rolling out this program. And this first came up, it was Commissioner Kristen Rosen Gonzalez in Miami Beach who really started to talk about this issue at the end of the year last year. And she had gone through her own alleged assault, and so she had talked to the hotel union, and there was discussions about bringing this this proposal here, which we had already seen was in the works at that point in Chicago and was already rolled out in Seattle.
So what exactly is a panic or safety button? What does that look like, and how will it work?
Well, it can range, but typically it's a handheld device. It kind of looks like the keys, you know, to unlock your car with a button. And it can be on a wristband. It could be on a keychain. It's supposed to be very easily accessible for the worker. And you would press the button, and certain kinds will just emit a very loud siren, you know, to let somebody know something's going on. But other kinds are more sophisticated, and so you would press the button and it would be connected to hotel security, so someone else would be alerted. They would know where you're located, and they would know what worker is pressing the signal to bring them over. And so that is the kind that we're probably going to see in Miami Beach. The ordinance specifies that the device needs to contact security, and that was something that the union had pushed for as well, because they felt that was a better way of alerting help. Some of these hotels are very large. If you call for help or you emit a siren, maybe someone might not hear you. And so they were really hoping that it would call security and be able to be a little bit more useful in that way.
And you interviewed some of the Miami Beach housekeepers and hotel workers. What were some of the stories they shared with you about sexual harassment or assault in the workplace, why this was needed in the first place?
Yeah, we've been hearing about this for some time. And all those stories we've done with the housekeepers, this is something that comes up all the time, even if unprompted sometimes. I mean, it's that common. So many of them had said, very commonly, what'll happen is they'll go into a room and the guest will be naked, or the guest will come in naked into the room. And so that, I mean, that's sort of a shocking thing for them. It's unsolicited. They're just there. Or sometimes guests will sort of suggestively invite housekeepers into the room with them. We had heard many incidents of this, of these kinds. And one of the housekeepers I spoke to said she was in a room fixing a bed, and she had a person come up behind her as if to grab her from behind. She was able to notice that was happening and run out of the room. And she said when she told her coworkers, they said, that's nothing. You know, we've had a lot worse.
Wow. And how did the hotels respond to this new requirement? Will it cost them more to provide this device to their employees? Were they open to it?
Yeah, there was a little pushback, and there has been in some of the cities. Initially, this ordinance had more sort of stringent requirements. The hotel, for example, would have to ban a guest for a year who was found sexually harassing or assaulting a worker. That got rolled back. Initially, this was going to roll out in January of 2019. That got moved back to August to give hotels some time. And that was, you know, part of the influence of the hotels wanting to adjust some of that language a bit. And so there was some pushback. And I think generally, you know, this is going to cost them. The burden of cost is on the hotel. No matter what size they are, it could be small hotel, large hotel, they all have to provide these buttons for a variety of workers. It's housekeepers, it's room attendants, it's minibar servers, it's room service servers, anyone who is in a room with a guest alone. So
this is not just for the housekeepers.
Correct. Yes, it's for any worker that's in a room with a guest alone at any point in time. And they really broadened that to specify that it could be different kinds of workers as well, because this happens primarily to housekeepers, but also to other kinds of workers. And so the hotels will have to provide this for everyone, and the cost can range. It could be an app that's $3 or $4. In Chicago, it's $100 for the entire system, which for each of the buttons, plus the individually for $100, and plus the sort of technology that has to be set up so that these buttons can contact security. So it could be onerous. And so that was really what the hotels were pushing back on. Many of them have their own safety protocols, and they thought that was sufficient. They didn't need to take this additional step. But ultimately, the commission voted unanimously to have them in Miami Beach.
And when you say they had their own safety protocols, did any hotel on its own have anything like a panic button before this?
Not here, no. In New York, for example, this isn't a citywide ordinance, but hotels that are unionized do have the buttons. So that's a situation where you'd see where some individual properties did have them because their workers were represented by a union. But here, no, we didn't have anything at all like this.
You're listening to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Call us at 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576 if you want to weigh in on this new policy that will be rolled out in Miami Beach, where hotel workers will receive panic buttons. Chibeli, is there a push to potentially have other hotels outside of the beach implement similar policies? Are you seeing anything regionally in South Florida that would potentially see this come, let's say, to Brickell or in the Broward region?
I haven't seen anything elsewhere in the region. I mean, Miami Beach is really the nexus of the South Florida tourism industry. The majority of the hotel rooms are in that area. And so that was really more of the focus. And also many of these proposals have come through the Unite Here Union, which is a hotel union that's in many cities in the country. And Unite Here locally represents mostly the workers in the Fountain Blue, Miami Beach Resort, and some other properties, but most of those are located in the beach. And so they were really the ones that pushed this through. And so they were more focused on their workers on Miami Beach. That's where the majority of them are. We haven't seen anything like it anywhere else. And then in other places in the country, there are some other pushes to get this through. In California, there's a proposed statewide bill. In Las Vegas, some of the unionized casino hotels with MGM and Caesars have added the panic buttons as part of their union contracts. So we are seeing this growing quite a bit in the last few years, but nowhere else in South Florida so far.
We're going to go to the phones with someone familiar, Miami Beach Commissioner Kristen Rosen Gonzalez. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you guys for having me on. I was driving and listening to the story, and I was so excited that you were covering it because this was a really big feat, a very big win for the employees of Miami Beach and hospitality.
Thank you.
So this was not, I did not think this was going to pass. We got a lot of pushback. I even had my colleagues were a little bit wary, and I was sure that the hotel associations, even until the last minute, the day before, we had to keep changing language and somewhat weakening the ordinance, but this is a very good first step.
You said weakening the ordinance. What do you think would have made it stronger?
Well, we had notices at first that were going to be on the back of the door, and at the last hour, we had to change it and say that they would put a notice someplace in the room so they could hide the notice that said that the women were wearing or employees were armed with panic buttons. They could probably put it in a drawer now or put it anywhere in the room. I really wanted this notice to be on the back of the hotel room doors, but they said that there was some state law preempting us. And at that point, we decided to just change the language and have it pass.
All right. Thank you so much for adding that to the conversation. Chibeli, did you, in your reporting, find you talked about pushback. Was there anything the union wishes got in there or wanted to be in there that didn't quite make it in?
Yeah, I think the ban on guests who were found assaulting or harassing workers was a big point. And in Seattle, for example, they keep a record of the guests who were found in these activities. And so I think that was important because they get a lot of VIPs, they get a lot of repeat guests. And I think they thought it would make the workers feel safer if they knew these guests were not coming back, at least for some time. But that eventually got taken out.
And what was the reaction from the union that this measure passed, even if it is a slightly not quite the version that they wanted? But what was their reaction?
For the union, this is still a victory. You know, in the greater context, we are the third city in the country to roll this out. And so for them, at any degree, this is still a victory and is a step in the right direction.
That's Chibeli Herrera, reporter with the Miami Herald. Thank you so much, Chibeli, for joining us.
Thanks, Nadej.
Finally, on the Florida Roundup this week, we look ahead to next week's schedule. Living in the Florida Keys seems like life in paradise, but is it? Tom Hudson will be back next week for a special edition of the Florida Roundup, broadcast live from the studios of Key West. He'll be speaking with people who call the Keys home, and they'll be answering some of your questions about life on the island chain. If you've ever considered visiting the Keys, or if it interests you, what would you want to know about Kunk life before you get there? Perhaps you'd like to know more about how it is to find housing or a job or simply availability of dog parks. If you have a question for our panel of Keys residents, we'd like to hear what you want to know about. Please text the word Roundup to 63735. That's one word, Roundup, to the number 63735. That will do it for the Florida Roundup. The Florida Roundup is produced by Bridget O'Brien. Our engagement producer is Katie Lepre. Teresa Afrontado is our digital director. Our news director is Terrence Shepherd. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Peter J. Meritz. Our technical supervisor is Jason Zapka. I'm Nadej Green. Thanks for calling and listening. I'd miss the entire pool and what became of sweet Melissa. And the boy nobody knew, did Ricardo ever find her? I swear it's just between me and you. But you can hear it on the Coconut Telegraph by now. Everybody knows. You can hear it on the Coconut Telegraph. Just who comes and goes.